Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, it's Francis, and this week we are bringing back a full hour episode on pizza, which sounds like a lot, but is really nothing compared to the 1,700-page four-book set on pizza that our lead guest Nathan Mirville produced. Anyway, this episode's a lot of fun. Check it out. I'm Francis Lamb. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM. You know, I was going to try to do this clever, interesting, discursive introduction to our show this week, but you know what? It's about pizza. That's it. That's all I have to say. We're going to talk about pizza for the entire episode, and it's going to be awesome, because pizza is awesome. But okay, what is there to talk about? Toppings? Yeah, sure. Dough? Okay. But if you ever wondered about how interesting pizza can be, spend a few minutes with a serious pizza maker, and they can tell you everything from how to ferment dough to how they move the pizza around in the oven to get the perfect cook. Or spend a few minutes with me and my guest, Nathan Mirvold. Nathan is a true Renaissance man. He is the former chief technology officer of Microsoft. He is also one of the world's most accomplished dinosaur skeleton hunters. I swear that's true. He's an inventor. He's also the founder of the Modernist Cuisine Lab, probably our country's most advanced research center on the science and creativity of cooking. And he and the lab have a new book. It's actually four books put together. It's called Modernist Pizza. It is almost certainly the deepest dive ever on the history, culture, and technique of pizza. Nathan Mirvold, it is so great to talk with you.
Well, it's great to talk to you too, Francis.
It has been a while. I think the last time we talked, you had merely written a five-volume book. And now, you know, is it 11 volumes later? We've gathered here today to talk about pizza.
Yes. My work is voluminous.
your new four volume book on pizza, and I want to start with a very simple question that actually, I don't know, maybe it's like a sort of existential question as well. What is a pizza? I mean, because you're talking about food that's traveled the world, you know, it's evolved. And you document this. It's evolved in many different climates and communities. Lots of pizzas look nothing like each other. And in fact, you have a piece I noticed in the book that talks about how many things in Italy are called pizza that you don't define as pizza. So right. What, in your mind, is a pizza?
Well, this is, you know, that pizza is a, as you say, a worldwide phenomenon. And if we trace the roots of that phenomenon, it's very similar to saying, well, who is Francis Lamb? And the superstar we all know and love, yes. Oh, but where did he come from? And in fact, you come from a very specific family of Lambs and other people.
Sure.
And we could trace your family back over time say that is the phenomenon that we're going to call Francis. So in the case of pizza, there are innumerable flatbreads in planet Earth. Yeah. You know, there's naan in India. There's tortillas in Mexico. There's zillions of others. Lefse in Norway and Scandinavia. And some of those flatbreads wound up with toppings on them. Would you call any flatbread with toppings pizza? And the answer is no, because you can't go onto any street corner in any city in the world and ask somebody, where do I find the lefseria to get your lefse fix, okay? Or, you know, pick your other flatbread of choice. You're not going to find it.
Sure.
What you find is pizza, and pizza came from a very specific lineage. It was a flatbread that became popular in the poorer parts of Naples in the late 18th, early 19th centuries.
Okay.
And that pizza back then was very different than the pizza we have today. But that pizza then rode around the world as people emigrated from Naples to America, to South America, and elsewhere. And along the way, pizza mutated.
Yeah.
And so if you took the strict rules of what there was in Naples in, say, 1880, 1890, when people started to leave, you would discover that it was quite different than what we call pizza today. Hmm. But that pizza phenomena occurs precisely because pizza left Naples, it came, and it, in the United States, it mutated a lot. And it struck a chord in this, at the time, still fairly young country. And that's why pizza is what it is. If pizza had never left Naples and come to America, it would be like so many other wonderful regional foods of Italy that you find in one city or a couple little cities nearby, and no one else makes it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's got to be 1,000 things like that in Italy.
Sure.
But this particular one gets to America, and then it gets mutated in lots of ways that causes it to take off.
Yeah. And you actually have a story in the book about how, on some level, you can credit cholera for giving the world pizza.
Yes. It turns out that one of the big events in Naples was a cholera epidemic, unfortunately. And that cholera epidemic caused the government of Naples and, you know, remember, Italy was not a country until 1870.
Right.
Prior to 1870, Naples was the capital city of a region called, oddly enough, the Two Sicilies, one of which is Sicily. Yeah. Which sounds like a crazy, it sounds like a bad joke, right? But that was literally the name of the country. Well, this cholera epidemic led people to say, look, we need to clean up the sewers of Naples and make it a more modern, safe city. And that created a large public works project called the Ristoramento, which sort of means renewal or rebuilding. Mm-hmm. Well, in the 19th century, when they did a large public works like that, which involved tearing down a huge chunk of the slums of Naples so they could build the new sewer systems and so forth, they didn't provide another place for those folks to go.
Yeah.
Although there were lots of economic reasons that people left Naples towards the end of the 19th century, there was also this very pressing reason that literally they were condemning, you know, huge, you know, blocks of Naples and tearing the buildings down.
Yeah. And those Neapolitan emigres, many of whom came to the United States, but all over the world.
Yep.
South America and all over the world. And they brought pizzas with them.
Yeah.
And pizza is obviously a very lovable food, right? Like it took root wherever it landed. So tell me some of the, I know you had, you traveled something like 100,000 miles eating pizzas all around the world. Tell me about some of the regional styles you found. I mean, well, obviously everyone knows, oh, they're thin crust and there's deep dish, but there's a lot more nuance than that.
Well, and one of the things most people don't realize is that South America was as much a hotbed of pizza as the United States in some sense. They, both mm-hmm. Brazil and Argentina, got large numbers of Italian and Neapolitan immigrants. And Sao Paulo and Buenos Aires have very strong pizza cultures, which could not be more different either from each other or from the U.S.
Yeah.
In Sao Paulo, the pizza is generally super thin. But okay. It's the other customs around pizza that are even more striking. We went to the first pizzeria to ever open at lunch when we were there just a couple years ago. Pizza was exclusively a dinner item.
Oh, that's so interesting.
And
it was formal.
It was a white tablecloth, formal thing. And it had been a tradition that was the fancy Sunday dinner that families would do. So the same way in more traditional parts of England, you might have a roast, or they'd call it a joint of beef on Sunday, you might have a roast chicken in some parts of America. In fact, it's pizza down there.
So interesting.
So it's a very high-end thing. It's, say, generally super thin crust pizzas with just a very smattering of sauce and cheese on. And they're delicious. Meanwhile, in Buenos Aires, it's almost like they set out to answer the metaphorical question, is it possible to have too much cheese on pizza? So in Buenos Aires, pizza is mostly a by-the-slice thing. Of course, they do have whole pies. They do take out of whole pies and so forth. But the classic pizza joint is a place that has some stand-up counters where you stand to eat your slice.
Okay.
But your slice has such a ridiculous amount of cheese on it, it's hard to believe. I mean, you think they're messing with you initially when you see this come out. And it's also delicious, but it's very different. The other thing that is bizarre about Buenos Aires is they have another flatbread, which is often served with pizza.
Like alongside your pizza?
Well, or on top. Oh, and it's called, the pizza a cavallo, pizza on horseback.
This is amazing. This is awesome.
It's a chickpea pancake, which is originally something that came from Genoa. Apparently, in the south of France, something like that's called fougasse.
Or like a panisse.
Or a panisse Nice. So across, sort of from Nice over around to Genoa, they have these chickpea pancakes.
Yeah. They're delicious. Like fried chickpea batter.
But
yeah.
It's a very minor part. I mean, you can find fougasse and panisse in France. If you go and you look for them in Genoa, you can find them. But like it's a minor thing. It's not like, oh, yeah, my God, there's one on every street corner. But almost every pizzeria in Buenos Aires serves it. And you can buy it by itself, or you can buy it put on top of your pizza. And the reason is the very first set of immigrants to Buenos Aires were from Genoa, not from Naples.
Okay.
And they created these chickpea stands. And the chickpea stands wound up becoming popular. Well, then as people from Naples came and pizza was introduced, they picked up pizza also. Sure. And so it's become this thing where it's arguably much more popular in Buenos Aires than it is anywhere that it originated.
Yeah, is fascinating. And this is one of the ways in which cultures evolve through migration.
Well, and then just by chance, of all the places pizza went, and of all the places people from Genoa and Naples went, it's only Buenos Aires that this caught on and became like a thing.
Yeah. I mean, you got to respect the double carb game. A flatbread on top of your pizza is really, that's awesome. Hats off. We're talking to Nathan Myhrvold, author of Modernist Pizza, and we'll be back with more with him in a minute. I'm Francis Lamb. This is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's table@hero.co. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're spending some time chewing the fat and the cheese and the sauce and the crust with Nathan Myhrvold, author of Modernist Pizza, the ultimate deep dive on everyone's favorite food. Let's get back to it. So you traveled, you know, we're talking mainly South America. You traveled all across the United States and elsewhere yep. around the world. What's a style of pizza that you fell in love with? What, like, that you're like, oh, wow, that's, or maybe one that you've always loved, and that's a, maybe that state has stayed your favorite.
Well, the first pizza I ever had was at a pizza chain called Shakey's, which, ironically, the very first franchise chain food in the United States was pizza, not hamburgers.
Really?
Not hot dogs. It was pizza. Yeah, Shakey's Pizza started in Sacramento, California in, I think, 1952.
Wow.
And Shakey's is still a big brand in Asia. I think they don't have many, if any, in the United States anymore. But in Los Angeles, that's what I had. So that was a New York-ish style pizza. And most chain pizzas started off being New York style. But, yeah, I like most styles of pizza when it comes down to it. We did find some styles of pizza that, in my view, were so aberrant that it was difficult to love them. I understand that there are people who love them.
Sure, sure.
from those areas, but it can be tough sometimes.
Yeah, we don't have to name names because I remember I was reading in the book. I'm like, wow, you're going to really upset. And then, you know, I won't say it out
loud.
Well,
actually, you know, I struggled with this in the book because there's obviously many cuisines on Earth, but let's take French cuisine as one standard. It's highly developed. It's a huge part of their culture, and it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And let's take sushi and more generally Japanese food. Well, you could say the same thing. Now, sushi breaks the rules of French food, and French food breaks the rules of sushi. But a open-minded gastronome has to respect both.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And you can't say, oh, I'm going to judge one by the standards of the other.
Sure.
However, as you try different pizzas around the world and some of the forms that they've come into, you do get challenged by things that are so, well, bad, for want of another word. You know, I wrestled with this. Who am I to say that a particular pizza style is bad? And I eventually decided, you know, there are some standards in cooking and in gastronomy that even if it's across all, even if you take into account all of the great cuisines of the world, this is still like a weird thing. So if you bake your pizza in a way that the crust doesn't actually get cooked, so it's this gummy, gooey, uncooked dough. I got to say that's bad. Okay? And it's usually, with almost every kind of pizza, that would be considered a mistake. Yet there's some kinds of pizza where the mistake is so habitual and so hard to avoid
that it becomes part of the aesthetic, yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. So the other part of the book, in addition to a highly opinionated, but also, you know, backed by a lot of research, history and cultural overview of this phenomenon is, of course, because, you know, the Modernist Cuisine Lab is, you know, a culinary lab, is like this incredible deep dive investigation into a million ways of understanding how to make pizza and in some ways how to invent new ones.
Yep.
And what I was really excited by was there were lots of findings for like pretty normie stuff like that any home pizza maker can use, not just people who have rotovaps to make the freshest tasting tomato sauce. So we do have a few callers, listeners of ours who called in with questions for you, and I'd love to share some of those calls with you. And I actually have some questions too, because I am a very amateur pizza maker, and I'd love to know more. But let's start the technical questions or the craft questions with Kay.
This is Kay calling from the lovely bluegrass region of Kentucky near Lexington. I'm working on perfecting my pizza dough, and I've been open to testing out new things. I've even been tossing my dough in the air, although I've dropped it a couple times, so I probably shouldn't do that. But anyway, I've been hearing a lot about double zero flour, and my question is, do you think double zero flour would make a difference for a homemade pizza? I'm using a gas stove that I'm able to heat to 550 degrees, and I have a cast iron pizza stone. I'm also currently using all-purpose flour. I appreciate any thoughts you have about that. Thanks, and love listening to you and the show so much.
All right. Well, thanks, Kay. The first thing, I want to say a word about the tossing the pizza. I love that she's trying to toss the pizza at home. And maybe the Julia Child spirit is you drop it, you move on, it's fine. But
well, of course,
is there ever a reason to toss the pizza if you're not like doing it for customers to like walk into your store and be like, wow, how's he do that?
No, it's purely show off.
Okay.
There's no great pizza. I've watched virtually every great pizzolo on earth make pizzas. And nobody throws it in the air unless it's a stunt.
Okay.
I mean, for like actually making pizzas, you don't do it. It doesn't help. Now, it's incredible what the people who practice can do. There's a pizza throwing competition at the Pizza Expo. And it's as crazy as the stuff you would see in the Olympics for gymnastics or that you'd see in a Cirque du Soleil show. It's like, oh, my God, you can do that with dough? But it's not really for making pizza.
Okay.
But to move on to the flour.
Yeah.
So what you're calling double zero flour would be an Italian pizza flour. Now, strictly speaking, in Italy, double zero refers to how finely ground the flour is. So there are double zero flours that are made for cake, for example, and you don't want one of those. You want a pizza. But in the United States, if you get double zero, it's probably a pizza flour. And the answer is I think you should give it a try. For most styles of pizza, we like a little higher protein than all-purpose flour. So for most kinds of pizza, we would use a bread flour. And there's bread flours from the major flour makers, from King Arthur. There's more artisanal ones from people like Central Milling. So there's a ton of different bread flours. Now, your recipe and technique also matter. When you use a little bit higher protein flour, the pizza can be harder to stretch. So I don't know how you're fermenting your pizza, but we strongly recommend that you ferment it at least overnight in the refrigerator. And that overnight sit in the refrigerator makes the dough much, much easier to handle. And it is what they do in Italy for their styles of pizza. Now, the other thing you didn't say is what style of pizza you are working for. If you're trying to make a Neapolitan-style pizza, it's probably easier for you to get close to that with that double zero flour. But a Neapolitan pizza is hard to make at home, at least in the full realism, because it generally requires an oven that's much hotter than yours.
Yeah. I was going to ask that, yeah.
Now, if you make a Neapolitan pizza at home with your cast iron pizza stone and your 550 oven, you'll still make something delicious. So don't be dissuaded.
Yeah.
But you might find if you switch to one of these other flours, you're going to have to change your technique a little bit. And, of course, in the book, we go into this endlessly about how to do flour substitutions and how to adapt your technique or other ingredients.
Well, let me ask you this. Okay, two things. Let's go back to the oven for a moment. So Neapolitan pizza is typically baked in a super hot oven, like 800 degrees or more, right? And very quickly, very thin, yes. Very thin pie, very lightly topped and baked for, I think, the sort of standard, the authentic standard is like something like fewer than 80 seconds or something like that.
Yeah, 80, 90 seconds. The thing is slightly unrealistic about the so-called authentic standard time is a real pizzolo is watching it like a hawk and they're moving it around constantly. Mm-hmm. And the problem with a very hot oven, and it's especially a problem if you have a wood-burning hot oven, is that the heat can be uneven.
Yeah, sure.
And so you have to move the pizza. And not necessarily constantly, but if you watch someone who's really good at it, they're doing this whole set of pizza gymnastics to turn the pizza around and move it closer and further from hot spots. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing that you need to realize is when you're baking a pizza, particularly Neapolitan, but it's also true for most of the others, you're baking with light, which means you're broiling, really. Some people literally use a broiler. But when you make the walls of your oven very, very hot, or the ceiling of a pizza oven very hot, its primary way of transferring heat to your pizza is with light, with infrared light that you can't see.
Okay.
This is why professional pizza ovens have an open door. If they cared about the air temperature, you wouldn't do that. Because, in fact, what happens is the cold air from the kitchen rushes right in that open door to get to the fire to go up the chute. So it goes, you actually are pulling cold air over your pizza.
Okay.
And we did a bunch of experiments to prove this. We made a little stainless steel strip thing that was on little stands so we could cast a shadow on the pizza. And if you cast a shadow on a pizza, it doesn't cook.
Even in a hot oven.
Even in a hot oven.
That's amazing. And this is the kind of level of detail that I totally geek out over. Like, the infrared light is actually heating things and not the hot air. But then, okay.
Yeah. But once you understand that, there's a bunch of things that helps with. For example, if you have things that are going to burn, like olives, you either put them on after the bake, mm-hmm. or you put them under the sauce of the cheese. They're black. They absorb heat faster.
That's awesome. Okay.
another thing we wondered, and this sort of may give you an idea of the kind of approach we take, is almost every kind of pizza has a puffy rim mm-hmm. and a thin center. It's true for New York. It's true for almost all of them. The rim is higher than the center.
Yeah.
Why? Now, some people say, oh, well, you leave more dough at the edge. Well, you can, but it turns out even if you make the pizza absolutely flat, you still get a puff at the rim. So we did tons of experiments, and we thought, well, maybe it's the weight of the ingredients.
The sauce and the cheese and stuff.
It's totally not the weight of the ingredients.
Huh. What is it then?
It's that the sauce is wet. And because it's wet, it's evaporating water.
Okay.
The evaporating water means that the top part of the pizza never gets above the boiling point. So I don't care how hot your oven is. As long as there's water there, it will boil and it will keep the temperature. If you poke a thermometer, as of course we did, below the crust, onto the top part of the crust, it can never get above the boiling point of water until the whole crust is dry, the whole sauce is dried out. Now, there's a flip side of that, which is if you make a white pizza, it's very different cooking that than a black pizza. So we made a pizza where we added squid ink to the sauce. It was much trickier to cook that, and it was tricky to cook the white one. In between, you have red sauce. And then we discovered something really strange about mozzarella cheese. So real mozzarella cheese, when you melt it, it actually gets whiter.
Uh-huh.
Now, mozzarella cheese, when you sprinkle some on your pizza, you put it in the oven, that mozzarella cheese is reflecting about 90% of the light that hits it. That's why it looks white.
Yeah.
It goes up to about 95% reflectivity as it melts.
Okay.
That's weird. And what that means is it's actually rejecting heat more and more.
It keeps it cooler underneath.
Yes.
That's so interesting.
But the crust is doing the opposite thing. So as the crust cooks, parts of it will start to dry out. And those parts that will dry out will then get darker. And a classic Neapolitan pizza has these spots on it. It's called leoparding.
Uh-huh.
And that leoparding occurs because you're heating the dough so fast that it browns, not overall, it browns in tiny specks, mm-hmm. which then ultimately would go overall. It's one of the reasons that Neapolitan pizza made in these very hot ovens is paradoxically, it comes out limp. And mm-hmm. the traditional Neapolitan way to have a pizza is very limp. It's not crispy at all.
Yeah.
There's a phrase in Italian that I can't say in Italian, but it translates as like a handkerchief. It's supposed to be like cloth when you take it out. Now, most Americans, when they first encounter that, say, oh my God, is this undercooked? Is this wrong? But I discovered a fascinating thing by traveling around Italy. Outside of the Naples region of Campania, all of the pizzas are slightly crispy. Mm-hmm. Even if they're supposed to be Neapolitan style, Italians like their pizza slightly crispy, just like Americans do. Oh,
that's interesting. Okay. But I remember going to Naples and having a pizza at one of the places that everyone raves about, Don Michele, I think. And this is over 10 years ago. And yeah, I was stunned when the pizza came out at how soft it was. And at some point I realized, like, you eat it with a knife and fork, and it was almost like, to me, at first I was, just so not used to it. And then I enjoyed it once I started to recognize it was almost like there was a pizza crust, that was a little chewier. And then in the center, it was almost like a bowl of pasta. Like it was more akin to eating a bowl of pasta.
Yeah.
And then once I wrapped my head around that, I'm like, oh, this is kind of amazing. But so why is it that way in Naples?
That's a really good example, though, of something where they have a different style. And I won't call that a mistake. I would call that, yes, that's their style. And you can get into it. It's pretty damn great. And it's a historical thing mainly, but the history of it was that people would eat pizza as a street food, but not as much by slices as by folding it up.
Mm-hmm.
So you take your round pizza, you fold it in half, then you fold it in half again.
Okay.
And that's called pizza portfolio. And you can't fold it up like that if it's as stiff as an American crispy pizza.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the idea of folding it up is you'd have something you could walk down the street with without it dripping all over the place.
Oh, I love it. We're talking to Nathan Myhrvold, co-author of Modernist Pizza. We'll be back with more with him in a minute and later. Can pizza help you revisit your childhood?
So I started visiting Chuck E. Cheese a couple years ago in an attempt to try to relive my childhood. And I have to say I had the pizza and I loved it. And I don't know how much of that was me trying to taste my memories. But I was trying to, I guess, eat my way back through to my childhood.
That's journalist Liana Agajanian, and she's coming up later. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's table at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. We've been spending this episode talking to Nathan Myhrvold, founder of the Modernist Cuisine Lab, about his years-long exploration of pizza. Let's get back to another caller, because we have John from St. Paul.
Hey. We just got an Uni pizza oven, and it's a lot of fun. It's super easy to set up, and we're having, you know, a great time trying different recipes and stuff. One of the things that's given me a lot of trouble so far is raw vegetables, I guess. Onions, peppers too, but really onions, like, I'm super cautious about keeping the pizza in there for too long because I don't want the cheese and the dough to burn. But the onions keep coming out pretty raw. Is it best to pre-cook them, you know, ahead of time, like roast them or saute them or whatever it may be, and then apply that to the pizza? Or is there a way or a thing I should be doing that, like, it cooks all in the oven at the same time from raw, but, like, cooks down and cooks out a lot of that raw flavor? Thanks so much.
So you have to pre-cook it. Just straight up. You have to pre-cook it.
Okay.
Something like an oven takes heat and time and also ideally a little bit of fat, because a lot of the flavor compounds in onions are fat soluble, to really cook well. So you need to pre-cook them. There is, with that monstrously hot heat that you're getting from the pizza oven, which makes your pizza good, you will never cook those things all the way through. Mm-hmm. So don't even try. Cook them up front. That's what basically everybody does that makes a pizza that has raw onions or peppers in it. Sometimes you'll see the raw onions or peppers put on top of a pizza that is cooked at a lower temperature. And there's some chance it will cook, but I prefer to pre-cook the things because it lets you have control over what's happening. Otherwise, you have exactly the dilemma that you mentioned. Do I leave it in longer for the vegetables? But oops, then I spoil the crust and the cheese and the sauce. Right. And I hate having that tension between ruining one thing versus ruining another. And the way to get around it is pre-cook.
I love onions as a topping on pizzas. There's actually a pizza near me that their specialty is a pizza with so many red onions on it. It's like an onion sandwich, which sounds like I would listen to that description and think that doesn't sound good at all. Only it's the most delicious thing. But they shave them really thin.
But if you like the flavor of raw onions, you wouldn't be asking the question he was asking.
Sure.
And frankly, If you put those same thinly sliced onions on while you were in a very hot oven, you know, if you put it on at the beginning so it was there for the full bake, you'd have a real trouble with a lot of the very thin pieces blackening and burning. And burnt onions don't taste good, sadly.
Yeah. But yeah, that's the other thing. Either you pre-cook, like you say, which is a great idea, or
leave it raw, right? I mean, there's a big debate, for example. Margarita pizza traditionally involves basil.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but if you put basil on a pizza that's going into a very hot oven, you will burn the leafy basil. So there are two schools of thought. There is the hide the basil under the cheese school of thought.
Yeah, protect it with the cheese.
Or there is the sprinkle it on afterwards. I like the sprinkle it on afterwards because the basil really is better fresh, and that gives you a very fresh flavor that's quite different than the rest of it as a contrast. But, you know, just me.
Well, let's get to one last question. There's a question I have for you. And it's about pizza sauce. So, you know, basil and tomatoes is, you know, one of the great flavor combinations known to humankind. You have this list of ingredients in the book for seasoning or adjusting or improving a tomato sauce. And I want to talk to you about that list a little bit because there are lots of interesting things on there aside from, you know, certainly salt and maybe acid or herbs. So tell me about some of these things that you suggest people add to a tomato sauce.
So the fundamental choice in tomato sauce is, first of all, are you taking it out of a can or are you making it?
Mm-hmm.
In Italy, they mostly take their tomatoes right out of a can, and they don't cook a sauce. They might macerate the tomatoes, they might drain them, and then they will try to tell you that their tomato is not cooked, even though it was canned.
And cooked in a can.
Therefore, pressure cooked. But tomatoes have a very wide range of flavors in them. There's sweet. Yeah. There's sour or acidic. There's a lot of umami flavor in them.
Yeah.
And then depending on other stuff, if your tomatoes are cooked or sun-dried or whatever, you can have a whole variety of other flavors. Well, the difference between a pizzolo and a chef is a pizzolo, and this is a very broad brush thing. I don't want everyone to be mad at me just for this. I have plenty of other reasons. But, you know, the tradition in pizza is you treat tomatoes like it's an ingredient that you can't mess with. Whereas a chef or a cook says, wait a minute, I'm cooking everything. I can season this however I want. And partly that leads to some making a cooked sauce for your tomatoes where you will cook it with some other ingredients and or you add these other flavors. And I think it's one set of the flavors that you add are about things that are boosting stuff that is normally in tomatoes. Frankly, that is particularly important for if you're doing something with fresh tomatoes. Fresh tomatoes, there's a few days per year in a few places where everything is absolutely perfect and you should do nothing to them.
Yeah.
But most fresh tomatoes, particularly supermarket fresh tomatoes, they're not as sweet, they're not as ripe, they're not as like 10 different things because of the logistics chain of how we get them.
Sure.
You know, so things that we have in our improving tomato sauce, that particular table is really about things that are emphasizing flavor tones that are already there. So we have acids like different vinegars or citrus juice. Mm-hmm. We have umami ingredients, MSG, anchovy oil, mushroom powder, soy sauce, Worcestershire sauce, fish sauce. If you go overboard with the fish sauce, then you'll have an overtly fish sauce tasting pizza, which you might like or not like.
Which actually sounds great, but yeah, go on.
there's a variation on marinara that has anchovies in it that's very reminiscent of, and yes, it could be great.
Yeah.
So yeah, A, experiment with Memphis sauce, but even if you don't put in enough to make it overtly be fish sauce tasting, just a tiny bit of that or some other umami ingredient will boost the umami that might be a little lacking. You know, then of course there's sugar or agave or honey. We also have a variety of recipes for sauce that are not just adding tiny amounts of ingredients. It's about, hey, let's make a whole sauce that is tomato based, but it goes in a different direction. And one source of inspiration for that, frankly, is pasta sauces. There's a zillion Italian pasta sauces that involve tomatoes. And pretty much anything that's a pasta sauce, you can convert to a pizza.
Like a puttanesca sauce on a pizza.
A puttanesca or
delicious.
A mistrata, or there's all sorts of things that involve, there's some tomatoes in there, but there's also some other dominant flavors.
Yeah. Like a ragu on a pizza could be awesome.
It is.
Yeah.
And
that sounds great.
And yet, if you do that, it's different, but it's still within the range of Italian flavor themes. So, but hey, you also could make a Thai or a Indian pizza. I've had butter chicken pizza that's actually very good because butter chicken, or it goes by a million other names.
Yeah, chicken mukni.
Right, that's a tomato and garam masala based sauce, and it takes you in a different direction, but it can be a delicious direction.
Totally. Thank you so much, Nathan. It's been so fun to talk with you. I could talk pizza with you all day long.
Yes, and I could talk pizza with you all day long. That's why I wrote a 1,700-page book.
All right. Well, I look forward to making more pizza and to seeing what the next subject is you're going to dive into. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Francis.
Nathan Myhrvold is the co-author of Modernist Pizza, and he left us a recipe for their artisan-style pizza, including their great dough recipe. Find it at splendidtable.org. So after talking to Nathan and hearing about his passion for the science and culture of pizza, we want to hear a little bit about another side of things. The emotional connection to a very specific pizza pie. Here's the writer Liana Aigajanian.
I think my parents took me to Chuck E. Cheese for the same reason that so many new immigrant families in America gravitate towards Chuck E. Cheese. It was cheap, cheerful, and a way to keep your kids occupied and happy. So it was a win-win for everybody, although I'm sure it might have been more of a win for the children than the adults. Pizza means being American in a lot of ways to me. It would not have been a food that would have so easily passed through into my house and my family's eating traditions had we not been in the U.S., although it is a very global food these days. When I think about pizza, I think about just adjusting to America. And so it really feels like a symbolic food for my family and how we started our American story. My first memory of pizza night was very exciting. My mom, who worked full-time while raising my sister and I, cooked every evening, as did my grandmother, who lived with us for a while. So the idea of outside food coming into the house was very new and thrilling. It's not something that we did, and so it was a very rare occasion. But pizza ended up being the one food that everyone agreed on that they loved. My parents really emphasized eating healthy with fresh ingredients, and pizza passed the test for them for some reason. And it has stuck around till this day. Even when I go visit my parents, ordering pizza is a tradition that we still have. Visiting Chuck E. Cheese for the first time was a very overwhelming experience in both good and challenging ways. To me, Chuck E. Cheese was like a portal to America. It was the physical manifestation of what it was to be American in a lot of ways, from the games to mingling with other children to the food, of course. It was just a way to explore my identity as an American, my emerging identity as an American. So I started visiting Chuck E. Cheese a couple years ago in an attempt to try to relive my childhood. And it was just the same way, overwhelming, but in a different aspect. The way it looked and the kids that were there, and it was kind of like an out-of-body experience watching these kids play the same way I would have. I have to say I had the pizza and I loved it, and I don't know how much of that was me trying to taste my memories or me actually enjoying the food, but so much of food are tied to memories, and so at that point it really didn't matter. But yeah, it was just, I was trying to, I guess, eat my way back through to my childhood. I don't think that it would be a regular habit for me to go back to Chuck E. Cheese, but I do get a thrill every time I drive through somewhere and I do see a Chuck E. Cheese. It does thrill me that outlet still exists. So pizza night for me is still very much tied to my family, and I know that whenever I visit my parents, in that trip there will be a pizza session, and it will involve us all being around the table and having a slice of pizza, just like we would the traditional foods that we have eaten for a long time, and so it has firmly become part of our table, and I don't really see it going anywhere.
Liana Agajanian is a journalist who writes about immigration, identity, and culture. You can check out her project on the hidden culinary impact Armenians have made on America at diningindiaspora.com. And that's our show for this week. Thanks as always for listening, and stay cheesy. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavadi, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table is created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lukey, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios. All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.